Hello, welcome to another Pharmacy in Practice podcast. Got a very interesting pharmacist on this evening, fellow Irishman, Stephen Hughes. Stephen's a pharmacist working down in London at the moment, and I'll let him introduce himself in a second or two, but he's got a special interest in antibiotics and obviously antibiotic stewardship. So would you like to introduce yourself, Stephen?
Yeah, happy to. Thank you for the invite, Jonathan. So my name is Stephen Hughes. I'm the antimicrobial consultant pharmacist down in the Chelsea and Westminster NHS Foundation Trust. I've been practicing the Chelsea hospitals for now about 5 years as the lead antimicrobial pharmacist, acting up as a consultant for the last about 2 years now. And before that, I did my specialist training in the Manchester Royal Hospitals, where I did a bit of antimicrobial stewardship, but before that I was a renal pharmacist and a critical care pharmacist, and was there sort of the jump into the antimicrobial stewardship world. I suppose the reason for getting into it was it sort of appealed to me and what I was interested in clinical pharmacy. It's a rather new area, or it certainly was 6 years ago when I was getting into it. It's still a lot of unknowns, still a lot of questions we haven't yet answered, and still haven't answered, to be honest. And I suppose that was part of the appeal. But also it sort of expands beyond the pharmacy team, so it's very much a multidisciplinary team. So I've got a lot of interest in the sort of quality improvement aspects, the sort of innovation aspects of healthcare. And I find that it sort of goes hand in hand with antimicrobial stewardship. We're looking at working quite difficult challenges, using often lean resources to better achieve outcomes for the patient. And usually the problems you're dealing with are quite complex. So you're looking at multiple systems relying on antimicrobials. And we've been sort of blessed with antimicrobials over the last 40, 50 years. They sort of underpin a lot of what we do in healthcare. I think we're very much taken for granted. And whilst everyone prescribes them, not all of us are experts using antimicrobials. And it's quite a nice mix to see different departments, different areas, views on antimicrobial prescribing, resistance. I think everyone knows it's a problem. I think antimicrobial resistance, we're all aware of it, but enacting behavioural change is more difficult. So knowing there's a problem and doing something about it is a huge challenge. So I think that's partly the reason why I got into this area. And it's certainly kept me busy since.
Very good. Yeah, no, and a good place to start. I mean, there's so much I want to speak to you about and ask you about, but, you know, congratulations on your role there, acting up as a consultant pharmacist. You look, we spoke on the video beforehand, and you look about 21 on the video, so you've obviously reached that milestone very early in your career. So well done, Stephen, for a start. I was quite interested. I mean, what sort of quality improvement projects are you involved in? Could you give a few examples of that? That sounds quite interesting.
Well, I suppose the whole aspect of antimicrobial stewardship is trying to do things better, doing things safer, and changing it on a sort of a trust level, or even we go across the trust into primary care. So that I think there's no barriers for resistance or antibiotic prescribing. We're sort of seeing patients in primary care, secondary care. So the QI projects sort of overlap. So it ranges from anything. We have students doing projects on how to optimize therapies, so drugs that we know are complicated, vancomycins, ammonia glycosides, sort of doing iterative projects to show that we can make them safer, better, and more efficient, and often using slightly unusual tactics to get your clinicians and your pharmacists to do what you want. So we use a lot of sort of the nudge theory to make things as easy as possible. I'm very much of the view that no clinician wakes up in the morning, or no pharmacist wakes up in the morning with the intention to prescribe something incorrectly or an antibiotic inappropriately or for too long. I think everyone's doing it in the sort of best interest of the patient. But understandably, as human nature, we cut corners. We do what we think is the easiest option, what is the easiest option. So what we do is to make things easier. So we're sort of quite lucky to have a lot of technical support in our trust. We have electronic prescribing, electronic record management. We can do sort of surveillance with these systems. So we can sort of use that to nudge and push our prescribers and pharmacists into doing the right thing. Some of the view that if you can do something easier, better, do that. So many of my colleagues spend a long time optimizing vancomycin dosing. We have just pretty much removed vancomycin off the formulary and replaced it with therapies that do not need therapeutic monitoring but have the same efficacy, stuff like teicoplanin and stuff like linezolid. In the right patient groups, they can be used and reduce the need for vancomycin. So instead of having a full-time pharmacist going around just amending one drug, we take two steps back, change the approach, change the guidelines, get agreement from everybody, and make things simpler. So we do that with a lot of things, try to simplify the guidelines, but making them as robust as possible. I think that's the crux of what we do, is getting that balance. Because you want to inform them to make the right decision, but and a lot of them will quite openly tell you that they do not care about antibiotics. They just want the right antibiotic for their patient. So getting it to them as easy as possible. So again, you can build a lot with electronic systems. You can sort of have a computer decision support system, so it automatically prompts the clinician to pick the right choice depending on patient factors. Again, that's making it easier for the patient, or easier for our prescribers. They don't have to think about renal function, allergies, etc. And they just get what they want is the most appropriate drug for their patient. So we do a lot of stuff like that using technologies, looking at sort of rapid cycles of audit and service evaluation. And again, a lot of the stuff is interpreting or sort of extracting data from external sources. So if someone's done something very well in BARTS, I'm always very keen to hear their experience and then look as if I can hack their stuff and implement it in Chelsea. So I'm always of the view that you can't, you can take whatever's in the NHS and use it elsewhere. So that the frugal innovation, I don't think there's any copyright. I don't think people, as long as you give them whatever, a bit of reference, people are very happy to share data. So I'm usually going around scrounging different parts of guidelines, stuff that I see that looks well or has done well in another trust, we're quite good at adapting it into local practice. So we've spent a lot of time building the structures in the Chelsea Hospital for Antimicrobial Stewardship so that we can be agile, be iterative, change guidelines very, very quickly. We sort of, we can agree with our wider stakeholder group very, very quickly and change guidelines. And this has actually proved very useful in recent climate where we've had to change guidelines pretty much overnight due to shortages and due to these sort of COVID complications. So that's a lot of what we do.
Mm-hmm. No, it's really interesting. There's, again, really interesting speaking to you. There's so much within that, Stephen, to go after and ask. I think... at the risk of oversimplifying what you just sort of touched upon, do you think innovation is happening quick enough in the antibiotic space?
Good question. I think there's certainly plenty of drivers. I think there is, everybody seems to be doing something in antimicrobial stewardship or antimicrobial resistance. I think it's now got its place on this sort of mantle as a big problem for the future of healthcare. I think our previous CMO has done great work getting it on this, the national and international agenda. I think there's lots of research focused on it. And I think there has been, particularly by American colleagues, some nice work introducing new therapies. But ultimately, it's almost the frugal innovation you want, the simple innovation for your patients who are going to the community pharmacy, going to the walk-in centres, something new tablet, etc. is useful. Having expensive IV therapies for your last line resistance is probably less useful. So I think some of that stuff we're sort of glossing over the 80% of patients who will need new antibiotics and focusing on the sexy superbugs that we are all distracted by, the carbapenem resistance organisms. So my worry is that we're focusing very much on the worst case scenario, or in practice, or the main complication of antimicrobial resistance probably won't be patients dying of UTIs, but it'll be patients who are having to take 2 weeks off work to come into hospital, otherwise well, just to have a intravenous injection 4 or 5 times a day to treat a simple UTI. I think that'll probably be the biggest impact of resistance. I think, unfortunately, yes, patients will still get severe sepsis with complicated multi-drug resistant organisms. That will always be the issue, and we're certainly seeing them as we speak in our hospitals. They're fortunately quite a small minority. It's still the common infections, the UTIs, the chest infections, where the main innovation is required. So it's something we're looking at in Chelsea is to sort of use our patient engagement in the decision support. So a lot of what we do still in microbiology, we're not that advanced as our peers in other specialties. We are still reliant on microbiology culture, which takes about 48 to 72 hours at the best of times. And even then, we're very difficult to grow stuff from a culture. So it's quite common that we empirically treat you. Quite honestly, it's a guess. We have a best guess, or we have an educated guess what you might need. And we sort of wave the patient off with a prescription of 5 days, 7 days, 10 days. We've no idea what official days we should be giving, but we give them something. We can argue about what's right and what's wrong, but again, there's no evidence to inform that. And then we just hope the patient gets better. And then the usual way we find out is if the patient comes back, they either come back and complain and say it didn't work, or they come back very unwell, and hopefully we learn from that lesson. But there's no robust feedback system from what we do in practice. So what we're trying to do in the Chelsea hospitals is to sort of improve the feedback, looking at almost like a patient-reported outcome measure. So when we do send a patient home with an antimicrobial, we get some feedback. And ideally, we get feedback if things aren't going well early, they can let us know early. So we, I think what we know from antibiotic resistance is antibiotic will become less effective over time. We will see more and more treatment failures. And I think we're seeing that in practice as we speak. What we need to do is be able to act upon that, and using the patients maybe to self-screen themselves, maybe bring home a thermometer, bring home a blood pressure monitor, and they can identify if they've got new symptoms or worsening symptoms of infection. They can almost self-screen themselves and present back to us sooner. This will have two advantages. A, with the safety of the patients, we're not just kicking them out the door as we do at the moment and hoping to do well. We'll actually get feedback from them, and we can triage them back to hospital if there is complications. But more important, well, less importantly probably, is we'll get outcome measures. So we'll know that over time, drug X works well, drug Y works less well, and we'll have more sort of informed decision making. We can have maybe more personalized medicines. So you could actually have technology that says, well, actually, Mrs. Smith, you are doing very well at day five. We give you a 7-day prescription, but let's stop at 5 days. We know that the shorter the course we give, the more less likely we are to select out resistance. But in practice, we cannot make that decision at day zero. So therefore, we have to go cautious and go the longest course, which is 3, 7, 14 days, depending on your indication. So by using patients, by using the technology, having more tighter feedback loops, I think you could personalize a lot of medication, which will be advantageous for our patients. So it'll stop them coming back in a septic mess, and it will give us some feedback so we can improve, learn, and change our guidelines and evidence base for the future. So I think stuff like that, I'm quite keen and quite passionate about getting into practice. I think there has been resistance in the past. I think the last 2 or 3 months, patients or the public's openness to using technology for healthcare has changed with COVID. And I'm quite keen to see how this new NHS app for reporting COVID symptoms goes, because it may be that if we have some confidence with using technology in healthcare, it might be a sort of a snowball effect and we might see further advances. So I think the technology is there. It's the changing behaviours and making it easy enough that the majority of our patients can use the technology, or the carers can use the technology. I think that would be useful. I think something like that would be a practical application for real-time management of patients with increasing risk of failure due to antibiotic resistance. And I'm sure that the pharma companies will continue with their drive to improve the new meropenem / whatever drug they choose to decide. And yes, we will use that for a select amount of patients, but yeah, it will be for small percentages, where a lot of work to be done on the 80-90% of patients are coming to the door each day to our pharmacies and to our hospitals.
I think it's really interesting. I must admit, Stephen, I'm not a specialist in your area, obviously, but my kind of broad view, and you know, as the expert, feel free to jump in and tell me I'm talking rubbish here, but when I think of antibiotic resistance, I think back to, I don't know if you remember being at school in physics studying about springs, and you've got Hooke's Law. I don't know if you remember Hooke's Law. So Hooke's Law basically measures where the elastic limit is. Now, what I think is happening in a very simplistic way with antibiotics is that we haven't reached the elastic limit yet. The spring's starting to wear out, but we haven't actually passed that point where the spring won't recoil. And I suppose the reason I asked that previous question was of someone like you was because I guess your challenge is, how do you do that, you know, that Bosropian thing of innovating before you need to? Because usually there's a crisis and then innovation happens, as we've seen in the last few months. And it's what's happening at the moment with COVID is obviously absolutely horrendous, but it's a salutary reminder that a lot of the barriers, I think, to unleashing the skill of people like you are political broadly or economic, aren't they? I mean, and I'm not sure, I'm not sure what the antibiotic drug market's like, what the drivers to produce new antibiotics are or aren't, but I suspect some of that's true. Would you agree with that, or do you recognize my sort of abstract sort of attempt at an analogy there?
I can see where you're coming from with your analogy. I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I think there is economic and political distractions, perhaps. And I think for the last 50 years, particularly with infection, antimicrobials, as healthcare professionals, we've expected the pharma company to come along with a new toy, a new drug. We get this new drug, we play with it, and it makes patients better, and it's better than the previous drug. I think that's what we're sort of used to. I do not have the same confidence in this in the future. There's multiple reasons, one of which is the pathogen. I'll come back to that later. But I think you sort of touched on it, the economic impact. So these therapies are taking more and more costly to develop. So to get a drug license in the 1970s, you need a lot less scrutiny. So you could get them to market pretty quickly. And we've all seen the sort of fallout of that. And nowadays, you need a lot more robust randomized controlled trials in select groups of patients, and you need to go to your EMA, FDA, etc. to get approval. And these cost billions of pounds to get drugs through. The antimicrobial market is somewhat counterintuitive. So if you are in something like diabetes, in something like cancer, if you come out with the best drug, everybody's going to use your best drug because it's best for patient. In antimicrobial practice, infection practice, if you come out tomorrow with the best antibiotic, some sort of new penicillin, for example, we'll all want to use it, but we will all put it on the top shelf and use it for our sickest patients. So the better your antibiotic you develop, the less likely we are to use it. We'll all accept it's a fantastic drug and we'll keep it for our sickest patients, but due to the fact that we know of the antimicrobial resistant pressures, that we will not be using it first line. So again, if you're a pharma company, you have a new therapy for diabetes, if you can show it's better than metformin, people use it first line. If it's not better than metformin, then it's unlikely to be used in practice. And it's something similar we have in antimicrobials. So the best therapies that are being launched tend to be priced pretty highly for something that is 2 or 3 weeks, mainly because they know it won't be used. And then it's a sort of iterative process that more costly they are, the less likely we are to use it, and therefore often they're not used at all. So next time they license a drug, they'll know to increase the price again. So some of these new therapies that are licensed as almost like meropenem sparing, so we know meropenem is probably our last line therapy, still our best therapy for a lot of indications, it's pennies. We can probably buy it for 50p, I'd say, locally. And these drug companies have spent a lot of resource, a lot of time, a lot of effort developing these drugs so we can use instead of meropenem. And if we use these drugs, we can save meropenem for later and select the pressure on resistance. These drugs are coming in about £4,000 or £5,000 for a 2-week course. And whilst we might say it's a nice idea to use, in practice, we're nowhere near ready to be using these therapies routinely. So these therapies are left with shelf, and yeah, we use them, we don't use them, etc. And therefore, the companies get a bit disinterested, and they don't use as much. So I think there is political impact required. I think this is where they can sort of incentivize the pharma by having almost like a national contract or a national reward system. And the NICE committee are looking at something similar to this, where they will sort of offer a contract to a therapy depending on its merit for antimicrobial, and they will sort of almost pre-purchase or offer a certain minimum spend of this therapy for the whole nation. So therefore, it's sort of taken off the individual trust, and it's sort of spread across the NHS. It incentivizes the large pharma companies to negotiate, develop the evidence-based practice that we require. And yeah, then they get onto contract and they can hopefully mass sell their drug of choice. So that is one option on how the sort of the political parties, the NICE committees, the FDAs of the states, etc., can help. I think that's possibly where it goes. But again, we're still very much reliant on a magic drug coming along to save us. And I think every time a new therapy comes out, what I like about antimicrobials is it's very predictable. Whatever we expose to these bacteria, they will overcome. I think we forget that bacteria have been around a hell of a lot longer than we have. They have been dividing and conquering for billions of years long before us, and they will be here long after we do. And we're just it's just sheer evolution. If you put any sort of external pressure on these bacteria, over time they will form some mechanism to overcome that. So whatever therapy we introduce, and every new drug comes out, they tell us it doesn't cause resistance. We sort of hide it, little giggle to ourselves, and then 2 years later we see the paper, resistance to XYZ. Yeah. So the one thing that is predictable is taxes, death, and antimicrobial resistance. So maybe that's somewhat discordant with your spring criteria. So I think whatever we do, you will select that resistance. And if you can stop using the therapy for whatever period of time, that resistance is likely to die or to die out or not be as prevalent. So usually the resistance, so going back to the bacteriology, when you introduce resistance, these bacteria have to do something extra to overcome antibiotic exposure. And that usually causes a bit of, well, a bit more energy. They expend more energy, therefore they spend, they exert a fitness cost. So over time, if you reduce that exposure, they'll go back to baseline, reduce that resistance. The problem is there is antimicrobials everywhere. It's in our, we talk about hospital prescribing, we talk about pharmacy prescribing in the community. We often neglect to look at our veterinary colleagues and our farming colleagues coming from a farming background. Antibiotics are used for all sorts in the agriculture, to fatten up our animals, to keep our animals well, for sort of herd immunity. Misused, it doesn't take much to get your hands on an antibiotic in veterinary. And what we're doing is we're all exposed to very low levels of antibiotics. So living in London for the last 5 years, I'm exposed to all sorts of exotic antibiotic resistance. I've never had an antibiotic in the last 15 years that I know of, but I will have antibiotic resistance throughout my GI tract as we speak. If you're on the tube, you're probably exposed to all these pathogens, just as you are at the flu, just as you are at COVID, and constantly touching our hands and touching our faces, as we know now from the COVID. And this is how most of the resistant pathogens spread. And if you're eating chicken, you probably have vancomycin-resistant enterococci and many other forms of resistant salmonella. So we're very good, are very efficient at spreading these resistant pathogens. I think this is one of the biggest challenges. So we like to think of ourselves as being quite good at antibiotic prescribing in England and the UK, but ultimately, wherever the weakest link is, that will be the undoing of us as a society, because if someone else isn't prescribing antibiotics as they should be, they'll select it resistance, and we're very good at spreading that.
And I mean, I thought that again, very interesting in what you were saying. I thought my spring analogy was going to be proven too simplistic. So well done, you've blown that out of the water.
Sorry.
And I also thought what you said about because you actually preempted my next sort of question, which was around. Well, it stems from. I think it was Jeremy Corbyn, in the last few years hinted that he might quite like to nationalize the pharmaceutical industry, which, to put it mildly, was an extreme stance to take. However, I think I would stretch to say that probably antibiotics is maybe the exception to that rule, and actually you've just described a contractual mechanism, maybe not to nationalize, but to definitely incentivize there. So that's really interesting as well. So moving on from that, in my own practice, I'm always sort of, probably too much actually, Stephen. I'm turning the light or the camera back onto myself, or the mirror back onto myself, I should say. And I'm always sort of asking questions of what I do and how I go about my business clinically and otherwise. And when I sort of think of antibiotics, I there's no easy way to put this. There's a lot of arrogance around certain practitioners. Now, I'm talking about all practitioners. I'm talking about the expert in inverted commas. So doctors, pharmacists, pharmacy technicians, any sort of expert in inverted commas. Do you think we're being complacent with antibiotics? Do you think we're ferreting? Because I get the feeling we're ferreting around doing a lot of stuff. But it's kind of like being on the beach, fending off the little waves and the tsunami's about to come. Is that fair enough, or am I being a bit harsh?
No, I agree with you, and most of prescribing is done by non-experts, to use your terminology, and I think that will continue. I think it's something that the sort of sub-speciality of antimicrobial pharmacists is quite a new thing. It wasn't required 15, 20 years ago. So there was a small element of it, but it was perceived as anybody could prescribe antimicrobials, particularly with penicillins. They are very well, they are safe therapies. They do not need much monitoring. They have a very low number needed to treat and quite a high number needed to harm for many of the indications we use it for. So we have been using it, and it has changed our practice. And as I touched on before, it underpins a lot of what we do in healthcare. So we would not do a lot of the interventions we do now without robust antibiotic prescribing or antimicrobials to support our prescribing. So we would not be doing bone marrow transplants. We would not be putting allografts into patients and giving them a high dose chemotherapy for the rest of their life without these antimicrobials. And a lot of it is the 80% of whatever it is in primary care is based on patients coming in, and it's difficult to change their behaviors. A lot of what we prescribe antimicrobials for, as a purist, in my view, is for almost symptom control. These patients, you could do without antimicrobials. We could give them the wrong antimicrobial and they'll still be fine. I think that's a lot of what we do. I think we sort of trivialized some of the prescribing in primary care. We were giving therapies that we know have got high level resistance with the safety of mind that most of these patients will be fine anyway. So what we do is we give drugs that we wouldn't normally give to patients, because it sort of keeps them happy. But I suppose my concern is the patients who are acutely unwell, we end up giving them first line, second line therapies. We know that they will not respond as we'd expect them to respond and end up in hospital. Changing or educating on the mass how to prescribe is a challenge. One of the main challenges is there's no consensus on what good prescribing is. So I'll say, if you want to see a good fight, get 10 microbiologists into a room and ask a question, and you'll get 11 answers usually. There is no, we work in an evidence-based free zone. 2020 sitting saying that sounds odd. In any other specialty, they have got robust randomized controlled trials that shows drug X is better than drug Y. In microbiology, we do not have those trials. It's very difficult to recruit prospectively into studies because these patients present with all shapes and sizes, with different presentations, critical acuity of infection. They have even if they had all the same infection, they'll have different pathogens causing the infection. And even if they have all the same pathogen, they'll have different susceptibility. So you have might have a very low susceptibility. So a small dose penicillin respond quite nicely. Some are borderline resistant, some are resistant. So getting large patients into studies to get outcome data is it's almost impossible. Anytime we do a randomized controlled trial, we spend years discussing how bad it was. So even then, when someone does step up and do a nice study, we're very quick to sort of point out the limitations, which unfortunately there is often many. So I suppose ultimately, we do not know what good is. We do not know what the best therapy for a patient is. And almost it goes back to the three rules. One in three patients give an antibiotic, they'll get better anyway. One in three patients give the right antibiotic to get better. And one in three patients, whatever you do, they will not get better. And again, that is what we sort of normalized in our prescribing. And that's probably what you see in your practice, that some patients respond to stuff that they shouldn't respond to. Some patients will always have recurrent infections and they think one works for them, but it shouldn't work based on their resistant profile. And a lot of it is subjective. A lot of it is symptom control rather than infection control. Changing that, I unfortunately don't have a discrete answer for that one. I think that is, if you're rebuilding healthcare from the ground up, you might do something different about it. But we have very much attached to antimicrobials as the solution to when a patient has got a vague symptom. We give this, and more than likely they would have got better themselves, and they therefore appreciate the antibiotic more. They associate it with improvement, and the next time they want it again and again and again. So and maybe touch on it later, but there is a lot of work looking at changing patient behaviors, and that is a specialty in its own, and getting patients away from that sort of the urgency that they want an antibiotic. But again, it's sort of human nature. If you've got a sick child, 6 months old, fever, you want to be doing everything for your child to make sure they do not get a bacterial sepsis or meningitis. You've seen the horror cases, particularly in healthcare. You see that the one in 1,000 cases that goes badly wrong, and they're very well publicized. And again, it gets very defensive. So you do not want to be that one clinician, that one pharmacist that, whether rightly or wrongly, stopped the medication because you thought it wasn't a bacterial infection. If that patient goes on to get a complication of a bacterial infection, meningitis, etc., it's very difficult. And so I think ultimately we are practicing defensive medicine, and it's very hard to get out of that corner. I think a lot of
Yeah,
what we
no, that's
do,
it. That,
going back to the,
yeah.
go on.
I was just going to say, sorry to interrupt, but I was just going to say that that is such like again very interesting. And it's not a slight on my medical colleagues who have sort of been training me over the last 3 years to do. You know, we've done a bit of on the day clinics and stuff like this, and I also do the did those respiratory post exacerbation clinics, but. That was one of the observations that I saw in the medical world. It's the I would call it like what if medicine, and antibiotics, but very much just what you said. They very much fall into that category. Oh, we probably don't need to give it, but what if? You know, it's and we just I think it's a rational and reasonable way to think actually, but it's. I think we need more data. Obviously, we need more data, and you've just articulated why getting the data is so difficult. I mean, one area, and this is kind of a ball, it's sort of a plug. So I'm quite interested in whether pharmaceutical care is dead or not, and also, well, also more fundamentally, what a pharmacist is as well. But going to pharmaceutical care is, you know, is it relevant anymore? And I'm not sure, but I'm trying to prove that maybe it is. And we came up with this term, technoceutical care, because so my hypothesis behind that approach was, and a lot of what you I'll tie it in. A lot of what you've said has sort of triggered me to make this point. a lot of the theory behind pharmaceutical care back in 1990 and beyond was brilliant and has been demonstrated in the evidence, of course. Pharmacists giving advice, and you know, in antibiotics, that would be antibiotic stewardship, complete the course, all that sort of stuff. But we've never been able to communicate with the patient properly beyond the dispensing bench. And pharmaceutical care was born out of a need to reduce harms at the end of the day. So I find what you say about patient-reported outcomes and, you know, what you're actually starting to do there is starting to look at new and innovative ways to gather that data. You're actually starting to innovate within the system already, and you're not waiting for, what I'm hearing is you're worried that you're depending on the blockbuster antibiotic to come and save the day kind of thing, you know. But I really think particularly that communication with the patient is critical. And again, very interesting what you said about for you, it's not, you know, you almost, well, both hearing when the antibiotic works is useful, but also what I'm hearing from you is that it's more important almost to know when it doesn't work and know early, which I find quite interesting. But I've spoken for about half an hour here, which has been very interesting, and I think we both deserve a prize because we haven't talked about coronavirus. So
no.
I suppose we better touch on it. What is there anything you've had to unlearn as a result of coronavirus, Stephen?
Unlearn? That's a good question.
No, I was just going to say it's a wee bit of an unfair sort of on the spot question, because it turns things back to front. You know, it sort of makes you ponder your own assumptions and so on and so forth about your own practice. Is there another way of asking that would be, what have you dramatically stopped doing, or what have you had to do differently? It might be another way to ask it.
Well, we certainly stopped lots of things on secondary to Corona. We continued to do a lot of stuff. I suppose I'm somewhat biased in the fact that we work in an infectious specialty. We normally flu takes up 3-4 months of my year. So respiratory borne viruses, I'm very familiar with. Obviously, this is a different animal and affects our staff as well as our patients in a more pronounced fashion than influenza. I've seen complications with influenza, but yeah, this has certainly changed practice. I think we've seen a change in what we do normally in NHS. There is nursing staff, there is pharmacy staff, there's doctors doing heroic shifts on our intensive care or critical care. We have staff members from all areas coming back to help out. All staff leave has been cancelled. So people are doing tremendous amount of work for our high-risk patients. It also puts us in an unusual position. So I would normally come in on a Monday morning, have maybe half my diary for the week penciled into meetings or teaching or some external sessions. These are all cancelled. So we are now 100% patient-facing. And at the moment, certainly, numbers have dropped. So it puts us in a difficult position. We're busy and we're often not busy at the same time, which is an unusual way to be. I think there's a huge emotional and physical strain on all of our staff. Like, a lot of respect for the nursing staff and the firms. Our doctors are working directly with these patients on ITU. It's a huge physical trauma putting on these PPEs each day between patients. But again, there's a lot of us in the back staff, or a lot of the pharmacy staff, that have sort of moved into an unusual role and having more time on their hands, which is it's an unusual usual balance. So we've had to change what we've done, and as I discussed earlier, we've worked on making things as iterative as possible. So we've had to sort of rebrand a lot of our guidelines. We've had to do a lot of sort of rapid audit, rapid research, pulling the data to sort of inform decisions. So back in March, the first when we're writing these guidelines, we did not know what we were treating. We did not know of any of the available therapies. There's been a huge amount of work between within the trust, but also across different trusts. We do webinars with the RPS and UKCPA, linking with peers, so that everybody's able to share the good work. So I think a lot of that is sort of reinventing what we have never seen before, and that's the management of this new novel coronavirus. There has been a lot of, I think one of the most challenging things is that there's not a lot we can do other than symptomatic control for these patients. And there's a certain helplessness that we as healthcare professionals see. So our critical care colleagues, our pharmacists, etc. We always want to do something good. And I think there's been lots of interest in these novel experimental therapies, antivirals, anti-inflammatories. We've been wanting to do them. There's been initially, there was a lot of pressure. I found myself often stopping at the sort of off-trial use of therapies. There was some data there to support its use, but we didn't think it was sufficient. And we were sort of seen as the bad cops stopping people from using these therapies. I think that was very difficult. So everyone was very emotionally charged. We were seen as being obstructive. And I think that's been supported now by our CMO coming out saying everything should be through trial. There's been lots of peer reviews, lots of the CTAG group is a sort of infectious disease group down in London. They produce sort of national guidelines and they sort of normalize what we should be doing for these patients. I think that has helped a lot. So I think the initial surge in this little 4 weeks, I think it was the unknown, the sort of helplessness that was the biggest pressure on us. We felt as if we should be doing something, we had nothing to do, or we didn't know what we should be doing. I think now that we've had sort of taken stock, the numbers are fortunately reducing in London. So this is a sort of almost a week of reflection with a bit more time to sort of regroup. We are desperately going through the data from the first 6-8 weeks now of patients looking at risk factors for ending up in ITU, risk factors for complications, which therapy linked well. It's not a randomized controlled trial, but it's looking at our data and it's trying to make sense with our patients. And I think that gives us some confidence of what's normal, and it's reassuring to sort of speak to peers next door and speak to colleagues in Imperial and in Guy's, et cetera, and say, well, they're having the same issues, they're having the same problems. We're at the share, again, what we said at the beginning, something that works well here, I can sort of share. So we've had inner sort of expert groups, so we can sort of share practice. I think there's beginning to emerge some bits of data, which helps sort of reassure us. So the big question obviously was, are you going to see lots of secondary bacterial infection? There's always a concern with these respiratory infections that you get a viral insult, it sort of causes your interstitial tissue damage, and then you get a secondary bacterial infection that usually causes the main comorbidities and the risk of death. And that's what we're sort of used to with influenza. So far, it seems to be that it's not as problematic with the coronavirus. So I think we're getting used to these patients coming in very unwell, what looked to be septic, and after being hammered around the head for the last 10 years on how to treat these septic patients quickly, being able to sort of change tack and say, well, actually, they're behaving septic, but we have a good, plausible reason for that. They have got COVID, they've got a hyperinflammatory response, they meet all the criteria for COVID, and we've had to adapt how we diagnose sepsis. We diagnose bacterial sepsis and sort of change behavior. So almost in the last 6 weeks, we've had to sort of unlearn our management of these patients coming acutely well with respiratory distress. So instead of default sticking them on an antibiotic and then getting the physios to do their magic and coming back 48 hours later to see that they're much better, we've had to sort of say, well, antibiotics, no matter how much we prescribe, aren't going to make much of a difference for these patients. There's other care we need to be offering, symptomatic care. So I think that's probably one thing we have had to relearn. And I think this is a long battle. I don't expect this to disappear overnight. I think we should sort of use this quiet time, I sort of say, dangerously in London. It is definitely our numbers are down. I just sort of take stock to reflect and to almost we're sort of having the chat about preparing for the next wave. And again, it's again what you touched on earlier about prepping for innovative practice. So we're almost setting ourselves up for 3 months' time. What are we going to do if we have a massive influx of COVID patients again? Plus, we need to keep business as usual going. Because at the moment, we started downing tools for everything. I don't think that can continue. I think even this week, we're seeing a lot of patients emerging from their shelter with, they have been sitting on pretty nasty infections, pretty nasty complications of therapy for a wee while, and they're beginning to come back to the hospital. So I think we're going to see a lot of that. A lot of patients who've been missed opportunity with stroke, they will need a lot of rehab. Patients who've had cardiac complications, heart attacks, etc. We will be seeing them for the next few months, presenting with probably second and third episodes rather than the first episode. And again, with the bacterial infections, we are seeing them coming in, but they usually come in much later. So instead of coming in after feeling unwell after a day, they're coming in 4, 5, 6 days, and they're much more complex and harder to treat. So what we're doing now is we're sort of planning for the future. How can we manage the COVID crisis? How can we manage to protect our staff and our patients, but also how do we manage to get business as usual back? And I don't know if you have much experience with stuff like OPAT, so that's our outpatient antibiotic therapy. It probably started up in Scotland, so we've sort of, again, stolen and adapted down south. But we know that we have patients who will need antibiotics for all the reasons they needed just 3, 4 months ago, who will not want to come into hospital, and for good reason. And
yeah,
mobilizing your delivery system so you can get patients home, getting patients taught how to do it themselves, getting pick lines in, having different streams of clean and dirty, and as in clean as in non-COVID and dirty as in potentially COVID or confirmed COVID patients. Because what we do not want to do is patients to come from their safe nesting at home into the hospital to acquire COVID-19 and come in with UTI, go home with a UTI plus COVID-19. I think that is probably one of the biggest risks we have at the moment. So we need to get back to business as usual so patients can come in with confidence to hospital, get their care, get their urgent cancer treatments, get their surgeries, etc., that they've been saving or cancelled for the last 3 months, whilst managing COVID patients and optimizing their care. I think that's the biggest challenge, and it's going to be the next 6 months we're going to be doing that, and before we have these vaccines come to save the day. So I think that's our biggest challenge. Yeah, fingers crossed. So at the moment we've had the first wave. I think there's a lot of exhaustion at work. We sort of, this week particularly, we're reflecting on what's gone and sort of anticipating what's going to happen and seeing if we can plan ahead. What we know now, will that affect us, or will that have changed our practice 6 weeks ago? Most definitely. How do we ensure that we learn from what's happened over the last few weeks and months so we can protect all involved and improve care? That's the focus at the moment for me anyway.
Very good. And I'm not going to keep you any longer. You've been, it's been really, really interesting speaking to you, Stephen, and listen, I hope we get when all this blows over, I hope we get a chance to catch up in person, because you've sort of whetted my appetite. There's so you're involved in very interesting projects and so on and so forth. You mentioned the next stage, and I think that's maybe that's a conversation for another day. But yeah, you're right. Like the next wave will come, and I know it's well documented, but the shutdown has led to, I mean, you mentioned stroke patients, but yeah, you know, basically anybody with a chronic disease or particularly acute presentations that maybe aren't presenting at the moment in the numbers that they maybe should, is a concern for the future. But maybe that's another thing that we'll have to sort of learn how to cope with down the line. I'm not sure, but listen, in the meantime, one final question. I mean, how are you and your team coping with things? You sort of mentioned that it's a completely unprecedented situation, but have your team stepped up, as it were?
Yeah, no, we work on a very close team, all excellent members of the team. And I think that closeness, that bond helps. So I think we've all sort of helped each other out during the challenging times. There has been times when you're I think the most shocking thing is when you're seeing patients your own age on ITU ventilators who've got similar or no comorbidities, just like we sort of see ourselves in these patients. And I think that's, yeah. I think a lot of my staff, myself included, we've had times where we've had to sort of pause and just, yeah, this is tough. So I think there's a very good support network in the NHS, but in our team, I think we sort of look after each other, and I think we need to do it. Even in the sort of wider pharmacy team, infection team, we've been fortunate. I've been working with these colleagues now for 4 or 5 years, so we know them intimately well. And people always ask about how we keep ourselves separate, but to be honest, I spend more time with my work colleagues than I do with my family at home. So as I call them, I think we did one of the calls, I refer to them as my work family. There's no point keeping 2 meters away from them. What they have, I have. So it is nice to be able to sort of share it with them and share our experiences. It's nice to not be in isolation as well. So being able to go into work and work with our colleagues and get that support is nice. I think if you're stuck at home dealing with this on your own, it would be a challenge in itself. So being able to go in and get back to some form of normality. And I think everyone is quite, I think there's been a lot of badness happened in the NHS, but I think morale is pretty strong still. I think there's been a lot of support from our local community, so I think that has helped. But yeah, I think there's a tendency that you want to work all hours, and I'm usually guilty of that, to be honest, doing your 10, 12-hour shifts. And I think it's important that you take time and sort of force yourself to take a bit of time away from the work, get away from the hospital, spend a bit of time out if you can. We discussed earlier about the lack of outside space in London, so it's limited. So it's important that you're able to sort of get that work-life balance. And so I think taking a bit of time out, having a small lunch with a few of your sort of close colleagues is quite useful and more meaningful than usual. As you sort of, again, as I said earlier, it's normalizing this very unnormal, non-normal situation and beginning to appreciate that everyone's going through the same difficulties and sharing it. So not a nice situation, but I think something we're dealing with much better than I would have expected. So sitting here 6 weeks later, I would not have anticipated things have gone as smoothly. I thought there would be more complications, but I think it's went very well. So certainly in our local trust, we've had amazing support and help.
Very good, Stephen. Yeah, very good. Listen, I've kept you long enough, as I said, so really nice. We've never spoken or met before, so listen, thank you very much for agreeing to come on. Genuinely, I mean, I know I say this about all my guests, but genuinely, really very insightful conversation there. And as I say, hopefully we'll get to meet in person. And most importantly, take care of your family, and please pass on my regards to your team as well.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to chat with them. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. I will happily talk about antibiotics all day, every day. So it's quite nice to get a bit of variety into lockdown.
Very good, very good. All the best, Stephen. See you soon.
Okay. Thanks.
Cheers.